So it's like, how do we empower the human builder with kind of an AI apprentice that handles, you know, these cognitive load, right? And, you know, it's not just about replacing the mainframe or, you know, but it's more about integration, right?
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to another episode of Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a group of researchers, product leaders, and business minds working at the frontiers of artificial intelligence to discuss and debate the week's news. On this week's episode, we have Miriam Ashouri, VP of Product Engineering, AI Governance, Skyla Loomis, General Manager, IBM Z Software, and Kautar El-Megrawi, Principal Research Scientist. Welcome to you all. We've got a packed episode today. As always, we're going to talk a little bit about AI, global AI adoption. We're going to talk a little bit about security by design. But I think one of the stories I want to start with today was actually to talk a little bit about modernization. IBM did this blog post recently talking about their work on modernization and specifically mainframe modernization, which I think is like a really interesting topic where, you know, of course, with AI, we're always excited about like, oh, what's the like, you know, like use of it to generate new code. But it seems to me, and Skyla, it sounds like you're the right person to talk a little bit about this, is there's a ton of work for AI to do with existing systems. And so maybe the question to you is, curious if you can give our listeners a sense of like what's going on in that world and what sort of mainframe modernization even is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what happens a lot of times when people think about mainframe modernization is there's this myth out there that that equates to migration to another platform. And a lot of times it oversimplifies and ignores why the mainframe has been around for as long as it has to begin with. And that is the quality of service that it ultimately delivers and the fact that it is a fully engineered stack top to bottom to be really optimized for the types of workloads that it runs. Now, it is not for everything by any means, right? So, you know, we really think about a fit for purpose model when we think about mainframe modernization. But a lot of times people will overly simplify it to a language, for example, like COBOL, and think, oh, well, if I change out the language, then all of a sudden I'll quote unquote be modern.
All my problems
right,
will go
right,
away.
Exactly. But COBOL actually is, I mean, it's incredibly performant. It, you know, compiles down to machine level code that is fully optimized throughout that full stack and interacts with a complex system architecture that is, as I said, fit for purpose for what it does. And there's often a lot of other techniques to think about this, you know, besides purely a language play around modernization. You might think about how you're modernizing your operations, leveraging, additional open technologies like Terraform and Ansible and OpenTelemetry, which all is available to manage and run your Z platform, as well as data integration patterns. You know, we can integrate into eventing, offering, you know, super optimized caching and data access methods with the platform that really thinks about more of this enterprise system view of how your application fits into your larger business objectives and how these open and modern technologies can help you manage more efficiently with less skills or less proprietary skills and be able to adhere and meet to your business requirements that are coming at you quickly.
Yeah. And so are you kind of saying, I mean, you know, I guess like the intuition is like, well, we just take COBOL and we switch out whatever's modern. Is kind of what you're saying that like, you know, maybe in 2050, 2100, we're still going to have COBOL, right? Like that in some ways, like this is actually like a really great language for the problem it's trying to solve. What we're trying to do is kind of just optimize it, right? Like in place. Is that really where the kind of like balance of thinking is?
Area? Actually most of our clients, even though we ourselves have offered tools for language translation for a couple of years now, most of our clients mm-hmm. are saying, actually, I want to stay in COBOL. Just help me understand uh-huh. my application space better, right? These applications have been written over many decades with tons of business logic embedded in them that isn't documented anywhere. And the folks that wrote the code are no longer working at the company. And we didn't always have best practices around documentation and, you know, even when we have best practices, not every developer does it, right? Not exactly.
I love that like, that's been a problem for like, since the beginning
right,
of computer,
not exactly
you know,
their
computer
favorite
programming.
Activity, yeah, right? So, you know, it's, I think that's where AI can really help. And actually having an ecosystem of AI tools is beneficial ultimately to the platform and helping it to be more successful and more approachable by helping our developers to understand the applications, de-risk them, help accelerate their ability to work on code that they're unfamiliar with just because it happens to have more longevity at the company.
Katar, maybe I can bring you into this conversation. I mean, I think one of the places my mind goes is, you know, I guess, Skyla, you were giving kind of like the most articulate argument I've ever heard for like COBOL's still great, right? And COBOL's like in a kind of an incredible solution. You know, it sort of strikes me that in the past, you know, if you've wanted to design new systems in COBOL, you've needed programmers who can do it, which has kind of required you to try to find these people, right? Because it's been like a language that like has kind of disappeared with time in terms of people who know how to use it really well. I kind of wonder whether or not all this mainframe optimization stuff leads to a really interesting world where people start saying like, well, I'm designing an entirely new system. Like maybe COBOL would be a great language to do it in. Like, I don't know if you think that like kind of the rise of this sort of, you know, kind of code generation era is almost going to lead to like, you know, so-called dead languages or old languages like coming back in new ways, because suddenly we're kind of freed from this constraint of like needing a programmer to actually know how to do it.
Yeah, that's a very interesting take here. Yeah, definitely. I think whatever can deliver the best performance, like, of course, you know, if you look right now at what's happening with the AI stacks, there's a lot of code generation happening, like you said, you know, deep down, you know, these deep learning compilers, like, for example, if you see what happens with the PyTorch stack. So the PyTorch, you know, 2.0 introduced torch.compile. And then beneath, you know, behind the scenes, there is, you know, Dynamo, there is Inductor. And then what they do, there's a lot of, you know, work around figuring out how to map, you know, the AI algorithms to the targeted hardware, and a lot of optimizations, things like kernel fusions, things like, you know, reordering things, and also, and of course, tons of code generation to really build these optimized kernels that do well on the hardware. So whether it's COBOL or assembly or C, C++, I think at the end of the day, I think we just need to pick what really delivers the best performance that we have on the silicon, on the, you know, these accelerators. So definitely, you know, I think, you know, these automatic code generations is a very key step. And going back, you know, to this modernization topic, I think the winning strategy here is these targeted transformations. So if you use AI as a builder, you know, these organizations can really extract, you know, the business logic, like Skyla was mentioning, like 4 years old code, and really wrap it in modern APIs. So it's like, how do we empower the human builder with kind of an AI apprentice that handles, you know, these cognitive load, right? And, you know, it's not just about replacing the mainframe or, you know, but it's more about integration, right? Allowing developers to use modern DevOps tool chains, you know, on these legacy infrastructure, and then understanding, you know, these embedded, you know, deep business logic that has been, you know, there for many, many years. So, yeah, but I agree, you know, these tools that allow you to do these code generations, they're really powerful.
Yeah. And Skyla, if I can turn back to you, I mean, one of the questions I've been kind of wrestling with, and this is part of just like the practicality of how this work happens, is, you know, how do you get good at using AI for these applications? Because it sort of strikes me that, like, you know, if you're going to train a model on all the code that's easily available, a lot of the public code is like not languages that are kind of like these older generation of languages. And so like there's kind of almost like a sourcing problem, right? Which is like, where does all of this kind of like, how do you create even models that are good at doing this in the first place?
Yeah, well, and I think actually our approach with IBM has been to not have it be only the LLM. Like, that's only going to get you so far. And we actually really bring a lot of deep static analysis, a lot of, you know, tools and understanding of the platform. Because often these code bases, they're not small, right? We're talking tens or hundreds of millions of lines of code, right, that an enterprise may have on this stack. And it's all interconnected. It's all intertwined. And that's a scope that, you know, there might be slight differences in how something shows up in one part of the application, but, you know, shows up somewhere else. And it's just too hard, really, for an LLM at this stage to be able to understand those nuances. And when they're then working at that scale to, in theory, automatically, like, you know, translate all of this, you know, you're going to have, there's inherently going to be hallucinations, there's going to be errors, there's going to be misunderstandings. And the challenge then also is that often our clients don't have ways of, they don't know exactly what the behavior is meant to be. They don't have comprehensive tests around this. And if you're using the same technology to create those tests, you're going to inherently have some of the same problems also, right? Likely show up in those tests. So you don't really have a way to validate that. I mean, these retail banking applications, for example, or core banking applications, pick your favorite industry, they're not like a compiler. Yeah, right. They're not like fully documented. You have the spec of how it's supposed to behave. You can run it and validate if it's right or not. These are applications where, something happened maybe to the specific bank in 1994. And, because of some lawsuit or something that happened or some regulatory audit or something, they made a change that's unique to them. And it's built into the logic of their application. And then it's been piled on and piled on, right? And maybe it's applicable to a subset of clients that were, built in at that time, but not going forward. This is the type of nuance and detail of the business logic that are built in these applications that you can't just expect an LLM all on its own to be able to fully appreciate and do. So that's where we really believe in marrying the power of the LLM, really kind of in more bite size or incremental chunks, aided by the human to be able, and then our static analysis and, deep program level analysis to really map out and understand the interconnections between all these pieces to help prompt the LLM in a smarter way, right? So there's a lot of prompt engineering and context engineering that goes into working with these LLMs to get the most out of them in these languages that don't have as much public code available.
Yeah, I love this kind of picture that you're drawing of almost like it's like this archaeology that needs to be done. You like open up the hood and it's like kind of searching through that world. And I guess in some ways, I don't know if you'd agree with this or if this is too strong of a statement. It's like there's maybe modernization that we probably could not have practically taken on prior to LLMs, right? That in essence, like the LLM is just getting us to like understand the code just enough for the human experts to be able to do the modernization. And so in some ways, like now more mainframes are like more potentially capable of being modernized than was true, I don't know, maybe even 24 months ago.
I think AI is a huge accelerant. And I think the scale and scope of the challenge before was so daunting that, it was hard to be to really kind of take a bite at it, right? And I think the scale is still large. So it's, to me, I think it's still really about an incremental approach. Focus on what problem are you trying to solve? Is it agility? Is it a particular area of the code that has a lot of transformation or is really critical to changes that are happening in your business that you want to re-architect because you want it to be able to be worked on by a lot more people at the same time or, expand to new capabilities and think about it in an incremental way, always focusing ultimately on the ROI that you're trying to achieve and then use these AI tools to help you accelerate that. The other thing that I think people don't think about is, well, if you're introducing all this change into your traditional environments, if you're still using old processes and old source control systems and not a modern DevOps tool chain and modern agile DevOps practices, you're going to be hard-pressed to get that much application change through your system in a way that manages your risk and ensures your quality. So as part of bringing AI into the system, you really need to look at, and we've had a number of clients that have done this very successfully, really modernizing your development practices. Now, it's not Z-specific and it's not rocket science, right? But it is cultural change and people change. And, we know that that takes time, but it's an important investment if you're really going to get the most out of the productivity and scalability, kind of throughput of changes that you can achieve with these AI tools.
Yeah, as always, it's like the cultural change is such a big part of it. So, well, that's great and a lot more to catch up on there. I'm going to move us on to our next topic today. I want to talk a little bit about this kind of interesting reality check. Some of our listeners may have seen it floating around on LinkedIn. It was one of those images that go super viral. And normally, I think we avoid that kind of daily viral content. But I think this one in particular was worth talking about. So a guy basically did a little visualization where he basically said, let's plot like the entire population of the world. And then we basically say, like, how many people have not used AI? How many people have not used a chatbot? You know, how many people have not paid for AI? How many people have not, you know, used a coding scaffold, right? Like Cursor or Claude Code. And, you know, not surprisingly, it just turns out that, like, the number of people who have actually used AI and used AI in the way that we spend a lot of time at MOE talking about is, like, tiny. And so, Miriam, this is maybe a good, like, point to bring you in on this conversation is, you know, I saw that and I'm kind of like, wow, okay, like, the we're just kind of getting started, which is, I think, a good way to feel because, like, the nature of AI is to always feel like you're behind. So I'm curious about just, like, your reflections on kind of, like, that visualization and I guess what it gets you thinking about.
Tim, I love visualizations that are data-driven. So let's talk about data and a specific report that you just mentioned. The population of the world, 8 billion people, right? Let's just assume that the numbers are correct. 84% have not used AI before. That translates to, what, 6.8 or 6.5 billion. Let's just assume if we want to get these people online, what is the cost and what's the size of the opportunity to make this happen?
Yeah.
All right, back of the napkin calculation. Let's just assume that AI interaction is going to be, hey, my appliance is broken. I want to call the company. When I call the company, AI is augmented. So a customer care, very sample situation. The average duration of a customer care call, a minute and a half. That's roughly 500 words. So let's just say half of it is AI, half of it is the person. It maps to 300 tokens. If we want to get that 6.8 billion people online, just for one single interaction with AI per month, you're going to need how many billion token? Roughly 1 billion token. So you're going to need compute to enable 1 billion token. If you map it to the GPUs of the world today, it's roughly 10 million H100s at the speed of 100 tokens per second per GPU. Just to put that in context, the entire GPU count of the world is estimated today to be in the range of 100,000 to low million. We are talking about 10 million new GPUs, right? So when I think about this, when I hear this, the size of the opportunity is like, wow, we can have infrastructure to power that up. We can have the electricity and all the resources that is going to power that up. We can have the talent that is going to put into work to build the data centers. Keep going up the stack, the technology that powered this up. So there is if you want to be positive in ROI, there is a cost associated that creates a lot of opportunities in a sector of the market, but also the value that is going to be created to make this investment make sense, positive ROI, the creation of value. And I think that's the sweet spot that I'm personally super excited about because that requires exploration of new use cases, new ways of thinking that AI hasn't explored because we need to think out of the box to justify that investment that is required to make this happen, right?
That's right. I think you're getting to exactly what I want to talk about is that like, you know, like a lot of things on LinkedIn, it's kind of like, you know, it's just like something that you pass by. But I think the more I think about it, the more sort of interesting it becomes because clearly the effect of the data visualization is to say, there's this like huge market out there for AI. But I think, Miriam, what you're pointing out, I think is really interesting, which is basically like, but also like the challenges we will need to overcome to deliver AI to those people is also like colossal. And I guess, I don't know, Kautar, like, I mean, on the hardware side, I'm kind of curious about how you think a little bit about this. Is that like, is the apparent giant market that's out there for AI even accessible right now, just given like the state of compute? Like, it would just presume, like, a build-out, which is, like, really, really crazy from even where we are right now. And everybody agrees right now that what we have is pretty crazy.
Definitely. I think it's the compute cost, the infrastructure cost, they're huge right now. So adoption definitely will depend on the affordability, the infrastructure, but also the trust. And how do we embed AI into everyday workflow, not just, you know, these standalone chat apps? And I really think, you know, of course, you know, these visualizations are showing us this, you know, this big kind of gap between the reality and the hype. You know, the tech communities are exaggerating the adoption because they see themselves using AI, but adoption metrics, you know, really tell a different story. So, of course, there is a real, you know, market here, you know, beyond kind of the Silicon Valley bubble. which is virtually untouched. And it's a huge runway for growth. But, you know, the barriers here, they're not just technical. They're, you know, a lot way beyond that. And the cost is also a big, you know, equation, you know, factor here. But I think if we want to maybe think beyond the bubble here, to really get, you know, my thinking is to really get to that true AI revolution isn't just about, you know, everybody using, for example, ChatGPT, but it's really when AI becomes invisible, embedded into the software and the services that people already use without really thinking about it as AI. And I think that's where we're really kind of say that, you know, we've reached, you know, the AI revolution. It will just become invisible. But of course, you know, that requires, you know, huge undertaking by government, by industry, by, you know, lots of different institutions and the infrastructure and the compute and, you know, the GPUs, all of that. You know, it's how do we get to that in a sustainable way? And it's not just about, you know, always building these large models, but, you know, tiny models, you know, the small LLMs are also a big factor of that because they reduce the cost, but they can also get embedded into, you know, everyday lives of gadgets and, you know, IoT and edge AI, et cetera. And I think to get that, there is a lot of research ongoing to really compress these models, make them efficient. We already see some really great POVs on that and, you know, demos, et cetera. But, you know, there is some runway here to really get to that reality.
That's right. Yeah. And I think the kind of like diffusion question is a really interesting one because I think, you know, in practice, we're not going to snap our fingers and have another 2 million H200s and the power to run those chips, you know, tomorrow, right? As yet, I think there's so much pressure to try to continue to drive adoption. And I guess, Skyla, I don't know. I mean, where that puts me is kind of like, well, maybe the future actually is like much smaller models everywhere and in everything, right? That like you need to find a way to kind of run these models on smaller and smaller devices with less and less infrastructure. Like it will turn out that like the future is kind of trying to come up with like clever ways of using GPT-3 to solve a bunch of problems. And that really may be where the next like 10 million users come from. Is that kind of where you think the future is headed?
Yeah, I think I do actually. I mean, I actually thought the analogy of the article or the post, I think put us at around 2005 in the internet age. I think that's actually a little generous, to be honest, you know, in terms of where we are.
We're like maybe 2001.
This age of AI.
You know?
And if you look at what the internet did in terms of transforming businesses, turning some things up and down, that kind of presumes the boom and bust already happened, which maybe we've had a mini version of. We've certainly seen a lot of growth and then some corrections in the market related to AI. But I do think to really scale it, these need to be very focused again on the outcomes that we're driving. And I think the challenge with AI also is that because it's not, you know, declarative, right? Like you don't know what you're going to get every time. How we apply that is going to change. And I think we fully wrapped our head around what are the right use cases for that type of technology, especially in everyday life. And so I think that's going to be an interesting dynamic that we see evolve. And as you get to these smaller models, well, they can actually be a lot more predictable too, in terms of, you know, when you're using them for the purpose that they're built for, you know, they don't know as much to kind of go wander around and, you know, potentially pull in, right? They're much more targeted. So they may become more reliable as well, right? For these specific targeted use cases, which are more in line with often what I think what we expect from these different ways of kind of interacting and using technology to solve our problems in everyday life. So I do think it's going to trend towards the small or perhaps a hybrid model, right? You'll use small as much as you can, but there are going to be some things where, yeah, absolutely, you want that reasoning, that large-scale thinking, that, you know, that creativity almost, right, that comes from those larger models. And so I actually don't think it's going to be either or. I think we'll see a lot, you know, we've swung the pendulum over to, I think everyone's enamored with frontier models right now, but the practical reality of implementing those for every use case and the cost that comes with them, plus the power and everything else you talked about, you know, is going to become a limiting factor. And so from a practical purpose, we'll just start to, you know, bring in smaller models, but bring them complementary in a hybrid approach.
Yeah, definitely. I was joking with a friend recently that's like, we're going to go back to the earlier era of like those desktop towers with the turbo button, where it's like the model will run largely on kind of low mode. But like when you really need the juice, you know, there'll be like a button that you push, basically.
Yeah, if I might add to him, of course, you know, yeah. I think SLMs are really critical for adoption because, you know, they really bring that local cheap AI to the masses. But they're alone, they're not enough. You know, they also break, you know, down when you have, you know, deep multi-step reasoning, cross-domain synthesis, you know, really doing novel problem solving. So, you know, as I think it was mentioned, the winning architecture, it's going to probably be like a tiered intelligence or layered, you know, stacks where you have SLMs everywhere, which kind of maybe the default behavior handling routine tasks. But you still need, you know, large models as these escalation engines where, but you only use them when needed, you know, for complex reasoning, for orchestration, for strategic decisions. But I also think, you know, we need something that glues all of these things together. Maybe the agents could glue it all together where, you know, SLMs do the work and the LLMs think when required, and then the agents decide who to ask and when. So it's like, it's kind of mirrors how humans work, you know, reflexes, habits, deep thinking. So, but, you know, I think this is going to be really, you know, important. And of course, you know, adoption, it's not, you know, isn't blocked, you know, by, you know, capability anymore. It's also blocked by cost, latency, trust, governance. So this is, you know, a complex ecosystem where all of these things need to play together.
Miriam, maybe a final question to you to close out this topic. We've been talking a little bit about like what would need to sit behind the distribution of AI to many more people. But I think there's something in your original response, which I found was quite interesting, was you are talking a little bit about like, well, we also need to kind of like reimagine what the applications even look like. And curious about how you think a little bit about that, right? Like, it seems, yeah, very obvious to me that basically how we have served the first X number of users on AI is going to look pretty radically different from how we serve like the remaining amount. And, you know, it's going to require new companies and new thinking and new product design. And it sounds like you've been thinking about that a little bit as well.
Yeah, I love it that you asked this question. The technology keeps changing. What we need to pay attention to is the paradigm changes. If you look into the past 2 years and a half, the whole market collectively was talking about AI augmenting human and human processes. The example that I use, you call to a call center to complain about your appliance broken. We augment AI. We handle some part of the conversation. Or you see, it's a human process that you go inject AI. What happened in the past month or so with OpenQA and all of those, I feel like it raised awareness about a new shift in paradigm, which is people augmenting AI. In that world, our processes are going to be changed. The way that we are conducting our life is going to be changed. I'm talking about the future, right? The future that we are excited about. A lot of processes are going to be automated by AI agents. Let's just assume for now we have a secure and governed way, a beautiful world that all of these are automated. And the role of a human becomes an orchestrator of an army of intelligent, powerful agents, AI modules available at your disposal to do what you need to do, to create new things. When I think about like 25 years ago, I was at a school. And then I was taking a math school exam at university. Calculator was banned because calculator was you were not supposed to use calculator. It was cheating. But calculator was a tool that we don't spend our time on manually calculating and do the problem solving to solve bigger problem. That's how I think about AI. It's just a tool that unlocks a lot of time and opportunities for us to go and solve a much bigger problem that today we are not capable of doing.
Well, that's a great response. And yeah, I think this will be like really one of the big questions. And I do think that actually it's going to lead to like a completely new generation of companies in some ways, right? That like, you know, there's no guarantee that like the OpenAIs and the Anthropics of the world will be the ones that kind of capture this next opportunity. They have a good shot at it, of course, but I think it's going to be like anyone's game. So I think it'll be really interesting to watch. I'm going to move us on to our kind of final topic of the day. Over the last, I would say, three or four episodes of MOE, we have been kind of tracing the lightning arc of OpenClaw from its inception to its current moment where, you know, the kind of originator of the OpenClaw project has now been hired by OpenAI. I really want to do a quick segment just to close out this episode about, like, what comes afterwards. And specifically how now competitors are trying to nip at OpenClaw's heels. There was a fun article that we caught in Computer World just this past week focusing on a company called Quill, which has an AI agent called Quillium. And I mention it just because I think how the company is positioning itself is really so interesting in kind of the wake of the OpenClaw sort of moment. And so I'll read this quote from the CEO of Quill. Quote, OpenClaw is like the ultimate in letting go. It's a little bit of gambling, says Michael Dougherty, Quill founder and CEO. By contrast, Quill is proactive AI with humans in control. And so, you know, I think we can talk about Quill. We can talk about their product, Quillium. But I think the more broad item that I think kind of comes out of the kind of OpenClaw experience seems to be that everybody's like, wow, this OpenClaw stuff, this kind of personal agent stuff is really, really powerful. But the main thing everybody's worried about is, like, security. there was a great tweet that bounced around. I think it was, someone at the open, one of the big labs ran OpenClaw, and it was, like, deleting all of their emails, right? And they had to run across the room to stop OpenClaw from running. It feels like the next stage of competition here, and Miriam, I'll maybe kick it to you to kind of start us off here, is really, like, how do you get sort of security by design for these agents? Because on one part, their power is that they can go anywhere. The problem is that they can go anywhere. and so, like, how we resolve that, I don't know. I don't know, and I'm curious if, like, you've got advice for your listeners on, like, how that is evolving and how we do actually make these types of tools secure for use.
Tim, 2 weeks ago, I was with our client advisory board, and I posed similar question to them. I said, what is the biggest challenge that you have as you're thinking about operating AI agents in production? The number one challenge that almost everyone acknowledged that's the one to focus was accountability. Who is accountable? When things fail, how can I audit the lineage and go back and see where this was coming from? Was it from the entity that trained the pre-trained LLM? Was it the person that built the agent? These agents, some of them are third-party agents. Some of them you build yourself, your own agents in less than 5 minutes. They connect to tools. So even if you build your agents, you give access to external tools that are out of your control. So is it the tool that caused that bad behavior? Is it the person that is stitched together, orchestrated a business flow or a workflow and put it in front of the user that this bad behavior happened? Or it was the end user, in this term can be a bad actor that did something. So who is accountable here? And when you go one level deeper, accountability is a big thing. When you venture to security, that's identity. What is the identity of the agent? Who is responsible for the actions that the agent is taking? But also, what level of access are we comfortable to hold this agent accountable to? When you go to risk and compliance lives and breathes risk analysis, the risk exposure. Okay, the task that is assigned to this agent, what is the risk associated? How can I define guardrails and policies? And how can I enforce that policy at the agent level for agents that are built somewhere else, some of them third party, and for the agents that are running everywhere? That's the complexity of what the world is dealing with. At IBM, we call it agent ops. Like that, we recognize that this is the problem. Let's see how we can solve it, right? Step number one, we need to really understand what the agent is doing, right? So it's okay to have an army of agents, right? But it's also important to know what they are doing so you have the transparency and traceability of their actions, what the agent is doing. Step number two is to make sure they do the right thing, right? So just knowing what they do is not necessarily ensuring that they do the right thing.
Yeah, right. I mean, so you can know that it's deleting all your emails, right?
Exactly. So that's where eval comes in. And at this point in the market, that's where enterprises or everyone in the market is struggling. Eval is not mature yet. It's evolving. It's rapidly evolving. Most of the technology players are focused on eval, and that's where the area we see every day something coming up. Then now let's say you ensure that the agent does the right thing. Like I have an army of agents. I define a task for them. I evaluate the process, but then I need to optimize. It's not that you can just say, hey, unless you want to burn cash, I have an army of agents. I want to send them to the most powerful LLM that is out there 24/7 when I'm sleeping. Do whatever you want to do. Hey, in the morning, you're going to see the cost. Right? So optimize all of those. And then last but not least, policy enforcement. How can I define what the agent can and cannot do and hold them accountable through the policy enforcement and guardrails that we are designing? I think these four areas is the areas that everybody in this market should think about when they hear OpenClaw or anything else.
Yeah. No, that's a great framework for thinking about it. And it gets me thinking a little bit about kind of like, okay, there's lots of levers, right, for trying to control the risk from these agents, right? I think, Miriam, you pointed out kind of like, well, okay, accountability and transparency are going to be one way of doing it. Kaltar, I'm curious from your perspective, like, do you think eventually, like, some of this security for agents will go down to the hardware level, right, where you basically say, like, hey, you need to have, like, you know, a cryptographic signature to run anything, you know, on this hardware? Or do you think a lot of these security issues will be dealt with, you know, really more at the software layer?
It's a very good question. I think it has to be both. It has to be dealt, you know, at, you know, the upper levels, the system level, and, you know, the hardware level. So I think security by design, you know, involves multiple layers. You know, it's, you know, you need first, you know, to have this blueprint for agents where you look at, you know, how do you do default deny autonomy with these explicit approval gates? How do you basically have this least privileged identity kind of given each agent as a separate, you know, identity? You give them a separate identity, and then you also have minimal scopes, you know, kind of short-lived credentials and so on. So all of these things need to be handled at, you know, the user space, not really at the hardware, at the application level, or at, you know, the frameworks and the orchestration layers. Isolation by default, I think, is also very important, you know, having these sandbox environments where you run these tools in hardened sandboxes, you know, container, VM isolations, no implicit file system access, no local shell by default. You have things like maybe an egress, you know, controls, you know, only whitelisted domains. And you need also to do this, you know, at maybe a firewall or policy engine level where you insert control layers between model outputs and tools like validating the arguments, enforcing things like rate limits, blocking sensitive patterns. So it's, you know, and also, you know, memory and data controls, you know, where you keep sensitive contexts, you know, or, you know, kind of think of it as local first where possible, and you separate kind of the task memory, the user preferences, the secrets. So it is a very kind of deep undertaking that has to touch across multiple layers and need to be treated as a first-class citizen, where you need to have the hardware and the software across multiple layers work together to enforce all of these gates.
Yeah, there's a lot to do. Skyla, maybe I'll give you the kind of final question here of the segment. You know, typically, I think when we thought about security or safety for software, we're kind of like, okay, we've got this program. Is it secure or safe? Part of the problem, it seems to me, is that like with lots of agents running around, you have this kind of problem where like maybe the safety of any one, two, three, four agents is safe, but the four of them kind of all interacting together is going to create some really unexpected outcome. And so that all kind of really seems to me that it's going to require like a pretty different discipline of thinking about kind of assurance and security. And I think you're in some ways a great person to talk about it, because I think right now, I assume that no one's like, here's my mainframe, you know, send in a bunch of agents and do whatever you want in it. But we want to kind of eventually get there. And so you need to be able to create some kind of assurance for these types of systems. And so I don't know, I think even in kind of like the specific case of mainframes, curious about how you think about like how long it's going to be until we can really kind of deploy multiple agents to work on this kind of thing.
Yeah, so actually we're already on that journey. So we actually do offer a domain specific targeted agentic framework that runs on the mainframe. And we are delivering agents and working with partners and others in the ecosystem to deliver agents on the platform. You know, aside from the developer scenario, which we talked about at the beginning, where certainly there's agents involved, but that's on code, there's controls, you can test, you can decide what you deploy. But we're actually talking about agents that are helping our clients with operations, with database, DBA activities, with, you know, helping to understand problems that maybe are happening in their environment. And we have clients that actually are interested in bringing business use case-oriented agents to the platform as well to perhaps take over some of the business analyst type of work that they have in their business, but leveraging mainframe data. And the way that we're really thinking about this is that there's, you know, security is really embedded deeply into the mainframe platform, and it's been built up, you know, over decades, audited, you know, sort of all the proof points right within the platform. And so whenever a user is effectively invoking an agent, we tie that back to those user's credentials and what the user is actually allowed to do on the platform. So no agent will be able to do anything that a user couldn't actually do with themselves. So if a user doesn't have access to go change a config or go change something on the platform, that agent's not going to do it either, right? Now, it may come, and actually our agents today are really focused more on giving insight, doing analysis, making recommendations. I think over time, as we build trust, it'll go to more taking action on a platform or maybe certain classes of actions. Like, hey, maybe a health check can go run autonomously and there are certain things that are considered safe, right, to potentially change or manage. And some of that might happen automatically, but still report, audit, you know, give the clarity as to where and how that happened by who and or what, as Miriam was talking about. So, you know, we're really thinking about how do we marry those agents into the existing security profile that we have on the platform and leverage what's there as opposed to trying to reinvent something from scratch. Because it's all really kind of baked in. So it becomes kind of reinforcing that way to leverage it.
Maybe a final note, the producers are passing along to me that, Miriam, you actually spoke a little bit about kind of security by design and sort of scaling with agents on a recent Tech Summit episode. Curious about if there's anything you would want to add from that episode or if we just should point people to it to listen if they want to hear more about this topic after the show.
Yeah, so I went deeper on a practical enterprise application. A fireside conversation with John Whitaker from EY, and we looked into what is the reality of the market and what agent ops mean for enterprises to actually get into the four levels that we talked about. Like if you remember, we talked about what the agent does, if that's the right behavior, how can I do the policy enforcement, and how can I optimize that? There is a wealth of different products out there, the same for our portfolio, targeting risk and compliance officers, targeting security professionals, targeting business users, targeting developers. This is a teamwork between all these personas to shape what is a good behavior of the agent and how can we enforce it. So a developer in this climate needs to work directly with risk and compliance officer to really understand those risks. Otherwise, it's just going to be, hey, automating a number of tasks. And we saw what happened on the news over the past months in terms of security breaches. So everything that we do is intentional. And that conversation, I encourage all your viewers to go in, was a down to the feature level product conversation and a demonstration of how can you do that with the technology that is available to you today.
That's great. Well, we'll definitely link to it in the episode notes here. And that's all the time that we have for today. Kautar, Skyla, Miriam, thanks for joining us as always. Hopefully we'll all have you on the show very soon. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.